Hello, everybody, and welcome back to the New Books Network. I'm Marshall Poe, the editor-in-chief of the network, and each week we scour the internet looking for interesting books. And this week I'm happy to say that we have Paula Michaels on the show, and we'll be talking about her terrific book, Lamaze, An International History. I should say that I witnessed a childbirth about, I guess, 10 weeks ago now. My wife gave birth to our daughter, Rebecca, and it was a beautiful thing, I suppose you're supposed to say, but I came away with the firm conviction that I never wanted to give birth to a child. I hope no women are offended by that, but it looked very difficult to me. And I've witnessed that's my third now, and every time I come away thinking, wow, that looked hard. So Paula's going to talk to us today about how the medical establishments in various countries tried to ease the pain of childbirth using something called psychoprophylaxis, which is a word that's going to enter my vocabulary now, and specifically the Lamaze method. It's a fascinating book, and I encourage everybody to go out and buy it. So let me say welcome to the show, Paula.
Thank you, Marshall. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. My pleasure. Could you tell us a little bit about yourself before we begin the interview?
Sure. So I'm a Russian historian by training. I got interested in the Soviet Union back in the day when the Soviet Union still existed. I grew up in a Russian neighborhood, Brighton Beach in New York City. And when I got to university, I had to take a foreign language. And I was choosing between Russian, Arabic, and Swahili, because I wanted to do something exotic. And I decided Swahili was too exotic, Arabic was too hard, and by default, I settled on Russian.
Yeah.
And I fell in love with it, and I started taking Russian history classes and basically took every class that was available that had anything to do with Russia, Russian, or the Soviet Union. I was at Northwestern University. And then I went off to graduate school at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and worked for many years at the University of Iowa. And now I teach international studies and modern history at Monash University in Melbourne, Australia.
Well, that's a terrific story. Although Russian is hard, too. I learned it. It's not easy.
So, it is not easy.
No, it's not easy. No, it's not easy.
But I have taken a little bit of Arabic, and I can attest it is
okay, I believe you. I'm not going to try that experiment. You'll pass on that. So tell us why you wrote Lamaze, An International History.
So in the spring of the year 2000, I found that I was pregnant. And I did what everybody does is they start doing research. And I went looking for a childbirth education class. And so I Googled the one word that I associate with childbirth education, which is Lamaze. And that took me to the page of Lamaze International, which is the largest nonprofit childbirth preparation organization in the world. And there was a link and it said history. And I thought, oh, I like history. I'm a historian. Let's click that. So I clicked it and it took me to this little short history of the Lamaze method. And the very first sentence was, in 1951, French obstetrician Fernand Lamaze traveled to the Soviet Union and blah, blah, blah. And I was like, what? Yeah. What do you mean he traveled to the Soviet Union? This is crazy. How is this possible that as a Russian historian, I did not know that the Lamaze method had anything at all to do with the Soviet Union? And that really got me thinking, like, well, I want to know more about this. And I kept, you know, sort of digging and digging at it and found out that, you know, not much, really, almost nothing had been written about it. There was one article in English on that Soviet backstory. And then so I decided I was going to write a book about the Soviet side of it, because I'm a Soviet historian. And then a colleague of mine, Roberta Manning at Boston College, said, oh, no, you should follow Lamaze back to France because he was involved in the Communist Party and blah, blah, blah. And I thought, how do you know this? But then I said to her, well, but I don't know French. She's like, oh, you know Russian. You've studied Kazakh. French is nothing. I was like, French is nothing?
Don't tell the French that.
Right, really. And so that took a few more years of me trying to work up the courage to embark on yet another language to get under my belt to do this project. But she was right. It was irresistible. And, of course, then once you follow him back to France, you can't stop there. You've got to go to the United States because that's the place where it's had the most popularity and where his name is a household word. And so really the project just evolved very naturally out of this completely sort of random accident of that had nothing to do with my scholarly career at all, but just sort of serendipitously intersected between my personal life and my professional interests. Mm-hmm. One thing led to another, and all too many years later, here I am.
Yeah. Well, it sounds like a detective story. I mean, you're learning new things along the way.
Yes. And it's always interesting when those things take you in directions that you don't expect, you know?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I know just what you mean. Far too few of my projects have done anything like that. A lot of times historians reinterpret evidence that is already present. I would say mm-hmm. that. I'm not going to – no, I think that's true. But this one, you're right. There's a revelation on every page for me. I did not know the Lamaze method had anything to do with the Soviet Union, and I certainly did not know it had anything to do with the wonderfully named, and we'll begin with him, British physician Grantley Dick Reed. Lamaze may be a household name, but Grantley Dick Reed is not. So can you begin the story with him?
Sure. So I will say that in certain circles, for example, among professional childbirth educators, Grantley Dick Reed is a household name. And there was a time in the United States in the 1950s when he certainly was also a household name then, too. But he has what his most enduring contribution to this history has been that in 1933, he coined the phrase natural childbirth. And so even though his name is somewhat forgotten, that contribution endures. Mm-hmm. And so he had this experience of being a physician, helping kind of middle-class women in Great Britain through labor. And then the story goes, he went to a working class woman's household to help her give birth. And she seemed to be not experiencing any pain whatsoever. And he asked her about this, and she quite, you know, naively seemed to say, is there supposed to be pain? And for him, this was this eye-opening moment of what he came to believe to be evidence that pain is not natural in childbirth, but is a product of women's fears. So he developed this idea of what's called the fear tension pain cycle, that a woman anticipates it's going to be painful, she tenses up, and from that tension in her body comes pain in childbirth, that there's nothing intrinsically painful about childbirth. Now, this sounds a little bit crazy to our ears. I think there are very few people who today would say there is no physical component to pain in normal birth. But I swear to you, he did in fact say this, mm-hmm. And he did really believe it, and he wasn't alone in believing it.
Mm-hmm. I was going to say, can we take a step, I don't know if it's a step back, can we talk about the environment in which he worked? And this is an environment that's really started to medicalize childbirth. How did people, let's say, British middle-class women, give birth in 1933?
That's a really important question, Marshall, because if you don't understand that, then you can't understand why there's this quest for a different way to give birth. Mm-hmm. So middle-class women on both sides of the Atlantic were mostly giving birth at home, increasingly giving birth in the hospital. The United States is kind of the leading edge of this curve. And middle-class women in the U.S. were attended by physicians. That was true in increasingly true in Great Britain, though midwifery had continued to thrive in Great Britain. So there's important differences between the two contexts. But there is the use of drugs to ease the pain of labor. And that started in the middle of the 19th century as the very beginning of that. Mm-hmm. And by the early 20th century, it's becoming more and more popular. And it's really gaining ground in the 1930s, especially, and into the 1940s. And there's a whole range of different options in Great Britain, nitrous oxide is very popular. That's not so popular in the United States, where they use what's called, it just flew out of my head.
It's okay.
Twilight. Okay. They use twilight sleep, mm-hmm. which is a combination of morphine and an amnesia called scopolamine. So women would wake up having no memory of having given birth, not knowing how they behaved during their labor, often feeling embarrassed that they might have behaved in some undignified way. The beds on which women gave birth were equipped with leather straps to restrain them because they were known in this kind of fog of a drug-induced hallucinations. They could lash out at the attendants. So it was not a pleasant way to give birth. And it wasn't one in which women were what came to later be very concisely expressed as awake and aware, mm-hmm. so that they couldn't really fully participate in their birth experiences. So it was in that environment of the use of drugs, whether they be painkillers or sedatives or amnesiacs, to ease the pain of labor and to really kind of remove the woman's consciousness from this situation of giving birth. And Grantley Dick Reed was trying to create a new way of giving birth that women would find satisfying and dignified, to use the words that they imparted to this natural childbirth method that he developed in the 1930s and then became more popular in the 1940s.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How did he find himself in the presence of you said she was not a middle-class woman, a lower-class woman. I don't know what to call it. How did he get there?
You know, I don't recall the specifics of that. I think it was he got called there, I think, by a midwife who couldn't handle the situation, if mm-hmm. I remember correctly. But it was not his normal practice to work with that population.
Mm-hmm. Okay, I see. It's a sort of a side question. Anyway, so what does he do after he witnesses this painless, I don't know what to call it, painless childbirth? What does he do? I guess he starts to research and how does he form the program he eventually creates?
Right. So he works with his own patients. And this is quite important, actually, because he doesn't really conduct sort of what we would see as rigorous scientific studies and have control groups and those kinds of things. It's really just based on his own kind of intuitive experience of witnessing births and, watching what works in his own practice. So it's almost quite anecdotal, really, what his evidence comes out of. And so he starts off by trying to educate women about what to expect in childbirth, because he has this idea that it is fear that is the source of the pain, not anything physiological. And so how do you get at removing that fear? And one way is by teaching women about what is happening to their bodies during pregnancy, labor, and birth, so they know what to expect. And so they greet it from a place of knowledge and confidence rather than a place of fear and resistance. Mm-hmm. And then he couples that with a lot of really, positive reinforcement, coaching women, trying to keep them calm, talking to them in a very soothing way. And some of his critics take this and say, look, he has this mesmer-like effect on people. This is about his own charismatic personality, and other charismatic doctors could do something like this, but it's not scientific evidence that it's anything other than the suggestibility of his patients. And he disputed that. He said, look, it's not suggestion. It's not hypnosis. It's about education and confidence and comforting women and being fully present for them to help them through this process. But after they've already been sort of trained to relax their bodies and anticipate what is going to happen in a relaxed and confident way.
Mm-hmm. At what point does he start to hold classes? Or does it become organized?
So from the very beginning, he is working with a nurse who is running these classes, and he does some of the training himself as well. And so that starts really in the mid-1930s, and then it expands by in the 1940s and 50s. But there actually, even earlier than that, there is precedent for childbirth preparation classes, not of this ilk, though, mostly aimed at immigrant women and kind of the working poor, with this idea of this kind of, you know, middle class benevolent women going into working class and immigrant neighborhoods when women are having home birth, and getting them to make sure that the environment is sterile. So there is precedent for childbirth education classes, but now those classes are being aimed at middle class white women instead of these urban immigrant working and poor women.
Mm-hmm. I see.
And so it's about it's less about creating a clean and safe environment, and it's more about creating a satisfying and dignified birth experience.
Mm-hmm. I see. So leap to the Soviet Union, and I want you to get us there somehow. How does psychoprophylaxis, if we can call it that generically, get to the Soviet Union, or do the Soviets invent it independently?
Yeah, so Grantley Dick Reed had quite a bee in his bonnet that they did not get it independently, that they ripped him off, and the Soviets obviously denied this, and I would say all evidence points to the fact that the Soviets came up with their method independently, and it did differ in certain ways. And so while Grantley Dick Reed's method is called either natural childbirth or the Reed method, psychoprophylaxis is this particular method that emerged in the Soviet Union that then got picked up in France. And so in the Soviet Union, parallel to these developments, beginning in the 1920s, there were several different researchers in the Soviet Union working on the use of hypnosis to manage pain in childbirth. And among those researchers, one guy, his name was Ilya Vilvovsky, and he was working in Ukraine in the city of Kharkiv, which had a very vibrant community of psychotherapists. And he became convinced after World War II, after having worked for, you know, 2 decades on hypnosis and childbirth to manage the pain of labor, he became convinced this was never going to be practical. Though he had success, it was very, I'm going to do it, I'm going to make a terrible pun here, mm-hmm. labor intensive.
Mm, wasn't it though?
to work one-on-one with each laboring mother, and that was never going to be something that could be deployed on a national scale to help millions of women. So he came up with this idea of having these group classes that would rely heavily on the power of suggestion, sort of encouraging women that, you know, there won't be any pain in childbirth. There's no reason to expect it to be painful. Everything is going to go well, kind of repeatedly reinforcing this positive thinking. And he coupled that with, like Dick Reed, education about what to expect in labor and birth. And he came up with his own system that was very similar to Dick Reed's, yes, but justified in a completely different way. So whereas Dick Reed basically, you know, his system emerged out of his own personal observation and his anecdotal experience, and he was not very interested in coming up with fancy schmancy ways to justify it. In the Soviet Union, Vilvovsky had a background in Pavlovian physical psychology. He was interested in notions of conditional response. And he and the team that he worked with drew on Pavlov's theory of conditional response, which, as you know, is the whole ringing bell, salivating, mm-hmm. thing, to explain how their system worked. And that was not at all part of Dick Reed's thinking. Mm-hmm. So they had this physical, psychological explanation about it, about training the nervous system and about the role of the cerebral cortex. And it just had the ring of science in a way that Dick Reed's work did not. Mm-hmm. And I think ultimately that plays an important role in why psychoprophylaxis comes to eclipse Dick Reed's method in many ways.
Mm-hmm. Well, I should say this has the ring of, I want to say in the post-psychoanalytic or post-Pavlovian world, the ring of common sense, because if you are conditioned to think something is going to be painful, you are going to fear it greatly, and it probably is going to be more painful when it happens. And it's certainly the case that women are conditioned to think that childbirth is going to be painful. I mean, it's in the Bible. Yeah. It's one of the curses, right? I mean, the fall, and so we get the pain of childbirth. I mean, that's about as deep as you can go in the Western tradition. This is a bad thing. Right.
Yes. But I think if you asked most women, they would say you are out of your flipping gourd if mm-hmm. you don't think there's a physiological component to it as well.
Right.
And I think that's where these mid-century guys, whether it's Dick Reed or Velvovsky or Lamaze later, have this it's this peculiar moment in the history of medicine where there is this consensus, albeit among a small group of people, that childbirth has no physiological component to the pain. It's completely in women's minds. And they explain that in different ways. Some of them turn to Freudian explanations. When it comes to the United States, it gets a lot of that kind of Freudian explanation. It has this Pavlovian conditioning explanation in the Soviet Union. But however you explain it, this idea that there is no physiological reality to the pain of childbirth, mm-hmm. I mean, I just think that sounds completely crackers.
Well, I think it does sound completely crackers too. I agree. But that notion did not die in the 1940s and 50s because I had a football coach who used to say, pain is a state of mind. That was his favorite thing to say. So when you went out there and got whacked, he'd say, pain is a state of mind. I'm like, not really.
Right. And there are good examples of cases where that is true, like phantom limb syndrome mm-hmm. is a good example. But those are really extraordinarily exceptional. And the reason why this psychologizing about pain in childbirth is so acute, I think, stems from a long tradition of a kind of readiness to explain women's pain in psychological terms.
Yeah.
Going back to ideas about hysteria, for example.
Hysteria is the great example. Yeah, that's right. So then something happens that can only happen in the Soviet Union, or I suppose someplace like the Soviet Union. I suppose it could happen in North Korea today. But in 1951, the practice becomes universal. How does that happen?
Yes. I love this. Like, does the central government just decrease by fiat? Everybody should do this. Mm-hmm. And it is in no other context that happens. And really the question then is, you know, why did they pick this? It was not the only method on the table. There were other choices out there. Nitrous oxide, which, as I said earlier, was popular in Great Britain, still is popular in Great Britain, is widely used in Canada and elsewhere, had first been used to alleviate pain in childbirth in the 1880s in Russia, in St. Petersburg. So there was a long and domestic tradition of nitrous oxide. There were also other methods that they were experimenting with. But it was this one that they plucked of all those choices to make national policy. And the reason for it, I argue, is that they could do it on the cheap. Mm-hmm. That this did not require great investment in the pharmaceutical industry. And the problem was that nitrous oxide was what the doctors wanted. But the Soviet pharmaceutical industry could not produce enough nitrous oxide, or the machines to there's a machine that allows you to self-administer without overdosing on nitrous oxide. These were made in the Soviet Union. They'd been made in Great Britain since the 1930s. They were also produced in the Soviet Union. But they couldn't make enough of them to go around. And so psychoprophylaxis became this way of doing something about pain in childbirth, being able to claim that the Soviet government was interested in the welfare of women and trying to promote fecundity after the demographic losses of World War II, but being able to do it on the cheap.
Now, I have to ask a question. I forget what they're called, the places where people go and give childbirth in the Soviet Union. Detdom? What are they called?
Right. Maternity houses.
Yeah, maternity houses. Were they around at that time? Were there a lot of them?
Yes, there were.
So the reason I mentioned that is it would be easier to implement a program like this if you had a vast network of these. Yeah.
Yes, that is a good point. It is, you know, it's a highly centralized system. Although whatever you're going to do, whether it's in the Soviet Union or in Great Britain or France or the United States or wherever, you're going to need the personnel to be trained to do it, and you're going to need whatever material to do it. So there's still those kind of physical obstacles.
Yeah, I mean, and you point out something, or at least you hinted at something. The people who do this have to be trained, and you can't, by administrative fiat, just train tens of thousands of people to do this.
That's right. And in fact, one of the maybe disappointing things that I've found is that really it really goes very downhill very quickly in the Soviet Union, because they really don't have the ability to back up those central fiats with actual action on the ground. So there are plans put in place to start to, you know, I mean, and we see this story in like every realm of the
Soviet.
Yeah,
I'm laughing because that's the story of the Soviet Union right there.
That's right. That's right. Whether it's education or the arts or the military or whatever, it is a common theme that, you know, the word comes down from the center, you do this, and then somehow that doesn't seem to happen, surprise.
Right, yeah, right.
And this is a good example of it. And from that fiat 1951 until Stalin dies in 1953, there is a big push for it, but it really falls apart very quickly in the context of the turn toward de-Stalinization and the thaw. So once there's this like lifting of restraint on the conversation in medicine, as there is in science and every other realm of Soviet society, then the detractors of this method are able to come out of the woodwork and in both active and passive ways sort of slow down this process until really it just grinds to a halt.
But for that brief moment after 1951, it is not only a top-down administrative initiative in the favor of women, let's say that and be honest about it, they were trying to help women, but it's also a propaganda tool, and this is how it gets us to France, right?
Yes, yes. So it becomes one of the ways that the Soviet Union touts its sort of vanguard role in, you know, making a better life for working class women, and also the innovative character of its medicine. So Fernand Lamaze is a French obstetrician. He works in Paris. He has two practices. One is a kind of posh private practice, but he also works at a clinic that's funded by the Metallurgical Workers Union, which then took me to work in the archives of the Metallurgical Workers Union, which is not a place I ever expected myself to be. So he's hanging out with all of these union people who are all Communist Party members. He himself is not a member of the Communist Party, but he's sympathetic to their cause. He's what in the old days you'd call a fellow traveler. Mm-hmm. That might be overstating it. There's a little debate about how sympathetic he was. But in any case, whatever his specific, you know, feelings about it were, we do know he worked in this hospital, in this clinic that's funded by the union, and the union leadership are all members of the Communist Party, as was not uncommon in France in those days.
I was going to say, if I could just interject, I always feel compelled when we talk about this era in European history to say that all the right-thinking people were left-leaning after World War II in Europe because the communists were way ahead of everybody else and the Nazis.
That's right.
Way and, ahead.
Yes. And I'd say especially in France and in Italy, the Communist Party is particularly strong.
Yeah.
And he winds up going on this basically a junket to the Soviet Union in 1951, the same year that psychoprophylaxis has become national policy. And he had just heard at a conference in Paris, a Soviet obstetrician named Nikolaev had given a paper about psychoprophylaxis. He was in the audience, blew his mind, and he's like, whoa, I want to learn more about that.
Yeah.
And so then he goes on this trip to the Soviet Union, and the story goes, the whole time he's just like, I want to see a birth using psychoprophylaxis, you know, demanding. And his handlers are like, oh, let us show you this lovely clinic here, and let us show you this model, whatever, institute there. And they go to Leningrad, Moscow, and Tbilisi. And each place he's demanding to see a birth. And then finally, at the 11th hour, they're on their last stop, they're in Leningrad, and he finally gets to go to Nikolaev's clinic and see a birth using psychoprophylaxis. And he is incredibly impressed. Now, personally, I would give my eye teeth to have been a fly on the wall in that room, because you got to wonder, what did they tell this woman who was giving birth, whose birth was going to be witnessed by this foreign guest from the capitalist West, who had been demanding for weeks to see the effectiveness firsthand of this method. So I would really like to know how she was prepped about how she should comport herself. But in any case, we know nothing. We don't know anything about who she was. We know that we don't know her name. We know she was a 35-year-old typist, and this was her first child. And she, in his eyes, gave no signs of any discomfort whatsoever. And he said that her body was completely slack during this process of giving birth. And he went back to Paris completely converted to this method and wanting to propagandize about it in Paris and start practicing it at his clinic. And his, his administrators, who were all, thought favorably of the Soviet Union, were members of the Communist Party, were enthusiastic about supporting him as a way of not just helping women have a more satisfying birth experience, but as a way of spreading the good news about the benevolent nature of Soviet power.
And then actually they begin to practice psychoprophylaxis, and it spreads, right?
That's right. So his clinic in Paris then becomes this sort of epicenter for training doctors really from all over the world and spreading word about it. And there's correspondence between this clinic and very far from flung places, Vietnam, for example. They're also communicating with Eastern Europeans, Poles, Hungarians, who are getting this method from the Soviet Union, but they're at the same time in communication with the French, who are promoting it there. So it's this whole global network of people interested in this alternative for, I must say, very different reasons than why the Soviet Union was promoting it. In the Soviet Union, they didn't have the money to invest in the production of drugs. In France, they had the drugs, but the drugs that were available at that time, especially Twilight Sleep, these were very powerful drugs that were known to have an adverse effect on babies. Babies would be born listless, drowsy. They wouldn't breastfeed right away. These are very powerful drugs. They'd have depressed breathing. And so there was a lot of concern, not only about women being able to have a satisfying and dignified experience, but about the health impact of these drugs. And so in France, unlike in the Soviet Union, they were looking for a way to approach pain from a psychological perspective as much for safety reasons as anything else.
So it enjoys some success in France. You have an interesting part of the book in which you talk about testimonials, which makes it seem as if it's working.
Yes.
Or am I wrong? Yeah, go ahead.
So they need – so Lamaze and his kind of right-hand man, a man named Pierre Vallée, they need evidence to demonstrate the efficacy of psychoprophylaxis. So unlike the Soviet doctors, they decide that they are going to gather testimonials from women who have experienced labor using psychoprophylaxis and use that as evidence in support of their project. So that is coupled with their own evaluations based on their observations of these women. So they have their own system where the physician scores a woman's performance on a scale of 1 to 5. And then they also at the same time afterwards interview these women where the women talk about what they've experienced. And one of the interesting things about it is that if it's not the very first time that patient testimonials are used as medical evidence, it's got to be among the very first times. And one, I also think it's interesting that in the late 1950s, that methodology flows back into the Soviet Union, and Velvovsky begins to do it. His dissertation is in part based on that use of testimony, which was not part of his method beforehand. So we see in the gathering of that evidence, not that the flow of this technique is not one direction, but that the Soviets are also watching what's going on in France, and they're open to learning from their students in this respect. And the testimony, I have testimony from the 1950s, from the 60s, from the 70s, and it's interesting how that changes over time, how women talk about their experiences differently. In those early days in France, they're very quick to give away credit for why they do well. They're very grateful to their doctors and to the midwives, and they're really ready to say, I couldn't have done it without this. This is really about them keeping me on track. And at the same time, they take on their own shoulders all blame for any shortcomings, and they feel tremendous remorse about letting down the physicians, about disappointing them, about not having practiced harder. And it's so heart-wrenching to read these stories of women who have had disappointing birth experiences and then beat themselves up over it. I think there's a lot of women in America today who can, for a variety of reasons, connect with that impulse second guess how they proceeded, the choices they made during labor, and feel disappointed with the outcome. They're of course grateful that they have a healthy baby, but feel that the experience could have been different.
Yeah, I can attest to that. That's definitely a lot of second guessing after you're done. So, in an interesting twist, and of course this was predictable. After the now named Lamaze method gets some traction in France, it jumps across the English Channel to Dr. Reed. What's his last name?
Dr. Dick
Reed's territory.
Great consternation, yeah.
Yeah, so tell us about that.
Yes. So I should say that technically, I resist calling it the Lamaze method yet, because I really think – so the first known instance of it being called the Lamaze method, I have that from 1956 is the first time I've seen that. And then I have Dick Reed once saying in like 1959, there is no Lamaze method. But it doesn't really catch on until it comes to the U.S. in the 1960s. Mm-hmm. So I stick with calling it psychoprophylaxis, especially because Lamaze, who dies in 1957, he would have been horrified by it being called the Lamaze method. Yeah. He would not have taken that much credit himself. But Dick Reed gets quite the wild hair about Lamaze and his shenanigans, because on top of everything else, Dick Reed, who I have to say, I have heaps of correspondence from Dick Reed, and he of all of the cast of characters in the book comes through as really the most vivid figure. And he's quite a prickly fellow. And I don't blame him, because he had been working at this for 20 years and had not gotten much recognition for it. It was only just beginning to make strides in Great Britain, the United States, also in Canada, in Australia, but had not made many inroads on continental Europe at all. And along comes this guy who gets this thing from the godless communists, who Dick Reed despises. He's rabidly anti-Soviet. And they're doing something that sounds just like what he's been doing for nearly 20 years. And they have the gall not only not to credit him, but when they do credit him, it's always in this like, well, there was this other method that this guy Grantley Dick Reed came up with that was an antecedent to this newer, more advanced method that we have to offer. So that must have stung. And I'm sympathetic with how bruised his ego must have been, but he just rants and raves. He is clearly just beside himself over what is going on in France. And what he doesn't have that Lamaze has is a whole network of people ready to help promote this method. So Lamaze is able in France to tap in to the women's organizations that are affiliated with the Communist Party to help spread the word of this. And Dick Reed has, there are women who are converted to be big believers in his method, but nothing like the kind of well-organized network that Lamaze has to marshal for his advantage. And so he just rants and raves in rage about psychoprophylaxis. And he says it's plagiarism. He says that this is a communist plot meant to convert women to the Soviet cause. And he really sees principally a political agenda behind the whole thing. Mm-hmm. But the reality is that women themselves only cared about what worked. They didn't care that it came from the godless communists. They wanted to use whatever worked best. And they increasingly became convinced that psychoprophylaxis had something to offer, whether it was different or could be used in a kind of complementary and integrated way, synthesized with natural childbirth. They didn't really care. But he, till his dying day, was very orthodox about his method being the first, the best, and the only.
Yeah, he does sound like a colorful character. Sounds bitter, but I guess. I would be too. So in an interesting twist, again, somewhat predictable, an American in Paris gives birth to a child under the direction of a Lamaze physician and writes a book about it.
Yes.
So it's actually Marjorie Carmel is her name, is that right?
Marjorie Carmel,
yeah,
yes.
Yeah, uh-huh. So can you tell us her story?
Yeah, so she actually is one of Lamaze's patients, but not at the Metallurgical Workers Union Club, oddly enough.
No, you have a picture of her, and she doesn't look anything like a metal worker.
No, she's an actress. She's quite beautiful and glamorous looking. She is a patient in his private clinic. She has this arduous but wonderful, satisfying experience. And then she comes back to the United States and she's pregnant for the second time. And she tries to find in New York City a physician who will support her to use psychoprophylaxis. And she can't find one. And that encourages her to write a book about her experience in Paris called Thank You, Dr. Lamaze, which is really where we can start talking about the name Lamaze coming into the American vocabulary and something emerging in the United States that is really identifiable as the Lamaze method.
Mm-hmm.
And so she hooks up with this woman, Elizabeth Bing, who is a childbirth educator and a physical therapist. And she had been training people in the Dick Reed method, but she was growing dissatisfied with it, didn't think it was as effective as it could be. And when she heard about Marjorie Carmel's experience, she was very interested in learning more about it. And the two of them got together with a physician named Benjamin Segal, and the three together founded what became known as the American Society for Psychoprophylaxis and Obstetrics, which really just rolls right off the tongue.
Doesn't
that name.
It though?
Yes. Also known as ASPO. and today called Lamaze International is what it becomes renamed as eventually. And that is really the start of a kind of organized movement to promote psychoprophylaxis in the United States in 1960.
Yeah. So it's precisely this time, or just right around this time, that, and I hate to skip back and forth, but you have to do this in international history, that psychoprophylaxis movement crashes and burns in the Soviet Union.
Yes, yes. And so in, you know, like I said before, Stalin dies in 1953. I don't mean to suggest that Stalin gave a hoot about psychoprophylaxis. I have no idea if he'd ever even heard the word. Right. Yeah. But it is a rather momentous occasion in the Soviet Union that really opens the doors to sweeping change in really every realm of scholarly investigation and everyday life. And among the sweeping changes that are ushered in is the beginning of the end of psychoprophylaxis. So one of the reasons why it appealed was not just that financially it was feasible in the Soviet context, but it also did have appeal ideologically, because it was based on Pavlovian physical psychology, and Pavlov was enjoying a tremendous fashion in the Soviet Union, and his ideas were used to justify all sorts of things in the early 1950s. And so it was kind of part and parcel of what's been called Pavlovism, this emphasis on Pavlov's contributions to science in a number of realms. And that ideological, that need to justify medicine and science on ideological grounds begins to recede. And there, it really is a moment of more open and honest debate about medicine and science in the mid-1950s after Stalin dies. And psychoprophylaxis becomes a casualty of that, mm-hmm. because in 1956, there's a big conference in Kiev celebrating the five-year anniversary of that 1951 decree that made psychoprophylaxis national policy. And it's not just an occasion to mark the anniversary, but it's also a moment of really authentic debate about the successes and failures of it. And what you see at that conference is, on the one hand, the obstetricians line up against it, and the psychologists line up in defense of it, Velvovsky first and foremost. And the obstetricians say, look, this is nonsense. It may help women to be calm and quiet, but let's not kid ourselves that it's really alleviating pain. It's altering behavior, but it's not actually alleviating pain. So maybe it has good use in maternity wards to keep women calm and quiet and make sort of the business of the maternity wards run more smoothly and the women more manageable. But it needs to be used in conjunction with real pain relievers. And you people are out of your gourd if you think that pain in childbirth is entirely in women's minds. Mm-hmm. And those obstetricians win the day. Mm-hmm. They get the upper hand in that argument. And it's really after that 1956 meeting that interest in psychoprophylaxis peters out, and it's still on the books. And into the 1960s and 70s, they're still gathering statistics on the number of women trained in psychoprophylaxis, which oddly enough is near 100%. It's one of those lies, damn lies statistics, and then Soviet statistics. So they're all putting it down that, yeah, we're training everybody in this, but there's no more meaningful research on it. By the mid-1960s, all research stops on psychoprophylaxis, and I could not find a single person, and I was in Kharkov, the place where this originated, I could not find a single person who had been trained in psychoprophylaxis or who had trained someone else in psychoprophylaxis. The closest I could come was someone who was a medical student in the 1970s saying, I vaguely remember hearing something about it. And that was in the birthplace of psychoprophylaxis. So it really just became completely, though it existed on paper, it did not really exist in practice anymore.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I see. So, I mean, it's interesting to note, and I don't know if you'd agree with this sort of retelling of what you just said, but the idea, let's just leave Mr. Dick Reed out of it for a second. The idea is born in the Soviet Union, and then it's sort of laundered in France. And then it jumps the pond, now decommunized and shorn of anything having to do with the Soviet Union, thanks to Marjorie. Is that her name? Yeah.
Yes,
Carmel. And then by a really kind of amazing coincidence, it latches onto the nascent feminist movement, rebranded as natural childbirth.
That's right.
It's so kind of remarkable, really, if you think about it.
It is, because, and of course, when you think about it, you're just like, there is no way Stalin was interested, or Stalinist Russia would, pardon the pun again, give birth to something that has anything to do with second wave feminism.
Yeah, right.
Like, what? How did that happen? Yes, it's, and the thing is, of course, that's our association with it. Like, if you ask somebody, well, what do you associate with natural childbirth? They might say, you know, Birkenstocks and hairy legs,
right,
and, you know,
yeah,
second wave feminism,
right,
or yeah, some hippie thing. Do you know what I mean? Those are the kind of pop cultural associations. On All in the Family, the 1970s sitcom, Archie Bunker's daughter, Gloria used,
yeah,
use natural childbirth, specifically the Lamaze method. And so those are those kinds of associations of that, countercultural and feminist associations.
Mm-hmm.
So that makes that Soviet backstory all the more mind-blowing,
yeah,
because further away from that, you could not get if you tried.
Yeah.
The feminist thing the reason it starts being called natural childbirth in the United States is because Grantley Dick Reed's method was in the late 40s and especially in the 1950s building a popularity in the U.S. And when psychoprophylaxis enters the picture, it is being built on a foundation that was already laid by the Reed method. And so what you have in the U.S. is this emergence eventually by the 1970s of a kind of synthesis of psychoprophylaxis and the Reed method to really be something quite different than what was practiced in the Soviet Union or in France. And feminists latch on to this idea of natural childbirth as a way to resist what they would have characterized as patriarchal obstetric authority, because it enabled women to manage the pain of labor while saying no to pharmacological pain relief. If you want drugs when you're having birth, then you have to have a doctor.
Mm-hmm.
Because you need to do it in a hospital. But if you can cope with the pain of labor without turning to drugs, then you can have a home birth, you can have a midwife, you can have a birth in hospital, but really kind of keep the doctor's role to a bare minimum. And so in that way, feminists in the United States saw it as a way to empower women to kind of take back control of their bodies in birth.
Mm-hmm.
and they embraced that. But that's a very different reason yet again for why to turn to this method. Mm-hmm. And quite interestingly, in France in the same period, for French feminists, it meant completely the opposite. In France, psychoprophylaxis had been promoted and was popularized, and there was a lot of encouragement, we could say, or alternatively, if you were a detractor, you might say pressure on women to rely solely on psychoprophylaxis to manage pain, even when they were asking or demanding drugs to relieve pain. So in France, the feminist cause became drugs should be available to women on demand. It should be enough that the woman asks for it. And so the feminist cry there became access to drugs, not resistance to drugs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, I find that fascinating. I think that one thing that really stuck with me from your book is that that particular moment where American feminists and women said we'd like more control or more power during the process of giving birth, that part stuck. I mean, I can tell you from personal experience that my wife was really quite in control of the way she gave birth. And we had midwives who also made sure that the doctors were there, but not really there. And that was an empowering thing. You know, I mean, she was in charge. There was no psychoprophylaxis, but it was very clear that they had asserted a kind of authority over the birth room that they hadn't had prior to that time.
Yes. And I would say that that is certainly the most enduring contribution of the feminist health movement to maternity care is the, you know, for all the criticisms that are rightly laid with conventional maternity care in the United States, there is no question that it is vastly different than it was in the 60s and 70s in terms of listening to women and having husbands present or partners present.
Right.
You know, that was something new. And it is unquestionably a more humane experience than it was.
Yeah. I mean, they used to have birthing theaters and now they have these birthing suites. I don't know
what
the history of those are, but they're quite nice. I mean, you could live in there. They really are nice. And
that's right.
And you give birth right where you stay. And, you know, they're the attendants, that is the midwives are there and they're respected by the doctors, the anesthesiologists, and so on and so forth. And in fact, in the hospital where my wife recently gave birth, there is a midwife clinic, I guess you would call it, just right next door to the hospital. And that's where you go for your appointments.
So, and those changes of bringing of the birthing suite of not, you know, rushing the woman on the gurney down to the delivery room when she's in the throes of hard labor, of having the partner in the room with them, accompanying them through labor and birth, of bringing midwives back into the picture. All of those changes are responses to a very clear turn that women in the 1970s were making away from hospitalized birth. It was always the vast majority of American women gave birth in hospital in the 1970s, but there were a significant number of women who were beginning to turn to home birth. And that those kind of more humane approaches to birth, getting rid of things that really had no medical foundation, such as shaving and enemas and having having lots of pillows and the baths, all of that is about trying to woo women back to hospitals and to turn away from home births and to feel like they could have a homier experience within the confines of the hospital.
I wanted to ask a couple, we've taken up a lot of your time, but I had a couple of questions. What effect did I don't know about invention. I think epidurals were invented like in the 1940s or 50s, but the widespread use of epidurals have. I mean, now they're just sort of standard operating procedure. And I heard this about Australia, and I don't know if it's true, but you're there. They're like women just schedule their births, and they're induced, and they go get an epidural, and that's it.
And that's not anymore.
That's not
more the practice here than it is in the United States.
Okay, good. Then I'm wrong. So tell us about epidurals.
Though the overall rate of epidurals is the same, pretty much. It's about 3/4 of women in the United States and Australia get epidural anesthesia. which is significantly higher than in Great Britain, for example, where there's a lot more reliance on nitrous oxide. Epidurals came into fashion in the 1970s, increasing in the 1980s and beyond. And there's debate about why. I mean, one reason is they are incredibly effective, you know, compared to nitrous oxide, which kind of takes the edge off pain, which actually may be enough for plenty of women. Mm-hmm. But epidural anesthesia gives you what a lot of the women who were seeking natural childbirth had wanted, which is the chance to be awake and aware and participate. Mm-hmm. So they're relatively safe. I'm not saying that there aren't risks involved, but they're relatively safe. You have complete clarity of mind. Mm-hmm. And there are obviously downsides. Like, for example, you can't walk around, which is something that promotes labor. But they came into fashion because, for one thing, hospitals had to give anesthesiologists something to do. And this was a good way to generate revenue. It's a pretty expensive thing to do, certainly compared to nitrous oxide. Yeah. But the other thing is customer demand. Mm-hmm. I mean, they are giving women a lot of what they want, which is the chance to be awake and understand what's going on around them, fully conscious and have total mental clarity and not experience pain.
Yeah. I mean, I guess my question is, when women became aware that they could get an epidural and it was effective in the ways that you say, how did the people that were preparing the women for childbirth adjust the sort of prophylactic techniques that they said, well, you know, we really don't need to do this. I mean, we went through a birthing class when we had our first child. They explained to us what was going to happen, and that was good. They talked to us about breathing, and that was good. And they said, you know, these are the stages that you're going to go through, and it's important the husband is there to comfort the woman. And it was nice being there with other pregnant people, I guess I would say. But we didn't talk about psychoprophylaxis.
No. So psychoprophylaxis in the 1980s changes from being a method of childbirth to being a philosophy about childbirth. And it is because the epidural really undermines the whole reason why anyone would try to use psychoprophylaxis. And so the childbirth educators, Lamaze instructors in the 1980s were faced with expectant parents who said to them, why do I need all this mumbo jumbo about the breathing patterns and the relaxation when I can just get an epidural and it'll do away with the pain with a lot less work? Yeah. And that's a pretty hard argument to make, a case against that. But they talked about it a lot in Lamaze International, saying things like, you know, about the raising questions about the safety of epidurals, also really emphasizing the issue of satisfaction. And that is really where natural childbirth is today. There's a lot of emphasis on, you know, this being an accomplishment, that it's something that women are able to achieve with their bodies. And for women who succeed at natural childbirth, that can be enormously satisfying to say, I did this. Yeah. For women who don't succeed, who tried, wanted to do it and don't succeed, that can be profoundly disappointing. And it's a quite a bitter pill because they feel like they failed at something.
Yeah.
And then there are other women who say a lot of you are out of your gourds because why would anybody even bother with that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I'm familiar with that notion that somehow you fail if you get an epidural. I found it baffling personally, but it's not me who's given birth to the kid. Right. So I certainly sympathized, and it's just hard to see somebody in pain holding off like that.
Well, really the one thing
I don't want to say, know, I'm not the victim here. I'm not the one giving birth. So.
Right.
I don't want to put the attention on me.
Something to chew on in terms of thinking about that is nobody would have a root canal without having anesthesia.
No, they wouldn't.
So why is it that we attach this special quality to this particular kind of pain? Mm-hmm. I think that's an interesting thing to ponder.
It is an interesting thing to ponder, yeah. I mean, I think that there are people who could answer your question. I'm not that person, but I think there are people who might. I mean, one thing that does occur to me, and that is that the what is the best way to put this? The training of the mind is something that is well known in lots of religious traditions, not particularly Christianity or Judaism or Islam, I think, but there are religious traditions that do this effectively. But it is very hard, and it takes lots of practice. And I just think modern people don't have time for that. I really don't. It's easier to just take the drugs.
It absolutely is easier to take the drugs.
Yeah.
I think
yeah.
someone who would want to defend natural childbirth and would answer that, the point I raise about a root canal would say, among other things, that, you know, for one thing, it's pain you know is going to end. It's only a limited amount of time you'll be in that intense pain. Mm-hmm. But they would also say that, you know, whatever drugs you take are going to have an impact on the child. We know that it passes through the placenta and you yeah. don't want that to get to your baby. There are, however safe epidurals are, there are risks associated with it. So there's medical and there's also emotional reasons why you would choose not to do this. And, you know, pain in childbirth is normal.
Yeah.
Whereas pain from a root canal is pathological.
Yeah.
So the idea of treating that as opposed to using the pain of childbirth as a signal for progress in labor and, you know, a healthy, normal progression of labor, mm-hmm. those are two very different things.
Yeah.
But whether that means that you should suck it up and endure it is a different question, you know. But I don't think that the answer lies in being too judgy about anyone else's choices.
Oh yeah, I would never. No. I know that I'm not a suck it up and endure kind of person, but I'm not gonna foist that upon anybody else. I'm not gonna do that. No way. I'm taking the drugs.
I'm taking the drugs in a second, man.
No way. I don't know what that says about me, but I'm taking the drugs. So the Lamaze organization, the International Lamaze, what's it called again? The
Lamaze International.
It still exists. Yes.
Yes. Yes, it does.
So what do they do now?
They advocate for evidence-based obstetric care, maternity care, and to increasingly have humane practices of childbirth and which are empowering to women and to educate women about all of their options in childbirth in terms of pain medication and who can be with them. And mm-hmm. And what they don't do is the whole breathing and relaxation technique has gone by the wayside.
It's fascinating. It's fascinating. Well, kudos to them for evolving, you know, in a kind of intelligent
yeah.
way. That's the people that run
and
that
fighting.
Organization. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. They weren't, yeah. I mean, they didn't commit suicide by idealism like the Soviet Union did. So Paula, thank you very much. We've taken up a lot of your time today. I really appreciate it. It's a great book. Let's close the interview by having you answer our traditional final question, and that is, what are you working on now?
Well, I've got a couple of irons in the fire. I'm actually doing a kind of some more work on Grantley Dick Reed. He, in the book, is there only as he intersects psychoprophylaxis, but he really deserves fuller treatment on his own. I'm actually going to London next month to do more research on him. And I'm also going to launch a project about the history of nitrous oxide. And I've got a title, which mm-hmm. is No Laughing Matter.
Yeah.
Ha, it's a good one,
Dave. Okay, all right. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
I got it.
That's just getting off the ground.
Off the ground, yeah.
Just
lifting up. Okay. Yeah. Well, I have high expectations for it.
Yeah.
All right. So anyway, today we have been talking with my friend Paula Michaels about her book Lamaze: An International History. And Paula, let me thank you for being on the show.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. My pleasure. And let me thank everybody who listens to this webcast. We really appreciate your support and hope that you tune in next week. Bye-bye.